bei Anruf Wettbewerb mit Justus Haukapp und Ruprecht Porzun von der Heinrich-Heine-Universität Düsseldorf.
Ring, ring, ring. Meine sehr verehrten Hörerinnen und Hörer, liebe Freundinnen und Freunde des Kartellrechts und der Wettbewerbsökonomie, hier ist wieder der allseits beliebte Podcast bei Anruf Wettbewerb. And I will switch to English now, because we have an international guest here today. But before we come to our guest, let me briefly introduce who we are. There is my colleague Ruprecht Porzun, the director of the Düsseldorf Institute for Competition Law at Heinrich Heine University in Düsseldorf. Hello, Ruprecht.
Hi, Justus.
And I'm Justus Haukapp, the director of the Düsseldorf Institute for Competition Economics, also at Heinrich Heine University in Düsseldorf. Ruprecht, what's the international guest that we have on the program today?
I think actually this is a premiere. I think we haven't recorded this show in English yet. So for our first premiere of this in English, we have invited someone from the Premier League of Competition Law, of course. And that is Inge Bernatz, who is the Director for Policy and Strategy at the Directorate General for Competition. Hello, Inge. Welcome on the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm flattered, and welcome to all our audience.
We briefly wish to introduce you. Of course, you are known to most people who do competition law and policy, particularly in Brussels, because you are a well-known name there. But you've been director for strategy and policy only since August 2020, I think, so for 2 years approximately. And but you had a career in competition or in antitrust before, right? Practicing as a lawyer in Belgium after your law studies at Leuven and actually studies at Saarbrücken University. Justus, I think this is something you share with Inge, right?
I think we never met, yes, but in theory we could have met in Saarbrücken.
Okay, that seems to be a hot spot for people to enter the business. And then you worked as a case handler in DG Comp from 2003 to 2010, and that was mainly on telecoms cases, Inge?
Yes, indeed, correct. I have, by the way, very fond memories of my Erasmus year in Saarbrücken. I started indeed practicing competition law at the bar here in Brussels with a Belgian law firm and an international law firm before joining DG Competition in 2003 as a case handler in the antitrust unit for telecoms. And from that on, I seized the opportunity of being able to do different types of jobs within the commission, also beyond the sphere of competition law. So I moved into the world of energy and tried to help creating an internal market for gas and electricity at the time. And then I moved on into employment and social affairs as the head of cabinet of the Belgian commissioner, Marianne Thees, responsible for this portfolio under the Juncker Commission. And as often is the case, I returned to my first love, competition law, in this job as director for policy and strategy. I'm quite thrilled about this job because it allows me to bring together not just my expertise that I build up as a competition lawyer, but to also, at this point in time, put competition law in the broader context of societal developments. And I think that has been really challenging over the past 2 years, and I'm sure it will continue to be an issue to pay attention to in the years to come as well.
Interesting that you mentioned this societal aspects, as you put it, of competition. Well, that's probably something we need to discuss in more detail today. You have an immense portfolio as a policy director in the field of antitrust. Our listeners are aware of the thousands of reform projects that the commission is doing. But for the start, let's briefly discuss the other pillar of your work that we are not so familiar with. At least I'm not. Justus, you know everything, but I don't. And that is state aid. And there's a lot going on in state aid. Justus, what's your impression at the moment, if I may ask you to give Inge a head start in this?
Yeah, state aid is in the, I think, at least in the academic sphere, a little bit of the pillar in competition policy that's not treated as well as the other three pillars in competition law and policy. But obviously, it's quite important. But I thought when I heard the European Commission or Ms. van der Leyen's the president's reaction to the Inflation Reduction Act in the US that here we go again. The state aid prescriptions or laws will be relaxed once more. Remember, we had the Corona crisis and we sort of relaxed state aid provisions. Then we had the, or we still have the war in the Ukraine and relaxed state aid. And once more, it seems like the reason changed from year to year, but the trend is the same. And I'm a bit wondering whether that may not jeopardize the common market in the very end.
I think that's a fair question to ask. I think the state aid rules were, of course, part of the competition rules ever since the treaty included from its inception competition rules. And they were a very important part of competition policy precisely from that perspective of internal market. The philosophy at the time, and I think it's still very relevant today, was very much like what use it is to go after anti-competitive behavior by undertakings if then through state subsidies the market can be distorted. Now, we are living, of course, in times, you mentioned the various crises, the COVID crisis, the fallout of the war in Ukraine. But more broadly than that, we see also fundamental trends, whether that is to make our economy a carbon-free one or to make sure that we stay on course also in reaping the benefits of digitalization, which require also to a certain extent public investments. So in that sense, I think public investments are a reality and they can have very pro-competitive effects as well. But it is important that there remains a form of control on state aid to make sure that it doesn't push private investments out of the market and that indeed the internal market remains intact. And I think at this juncture, there is an intense debate about it because the amounts of public money going into the economy are very substantial. The intensity of global competition is very, very big. Including, for example, as a result of US policy around the Inflation Reduction Act. And that is why I think it's also a very good issue that this topic is raised at the highest political levels. There is, as we speak, an informal competitiveness council ongoing in Stockholm, where the issue is on the agenda. And later this week, there will be a European Council meeting here in Brussels, where also heads of state and government will look into the issue of how state aid control is a tool to keep our internal market intact in today's context.
Yeah, it will probably be quite challenging given the different state of affairs of public finances in the various member states. I assume that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to say, that we want to somehow react to the developments in the US and China, but don't sort of give up the common market at the same time. The balance may be quite delicate, I would assume.
No, absolutely. I think, as Vice President Vestager also said last week, not all member states are in the same position when it comes to state aid, and some member states have deeper pockets than others. But that being said, I think it's also a fundamental debate about, and that for me is part of the wider debate on the role of competition policy in stimulating competitiveness of our economy. What do we think will make European industry best equipped to compete, to innovate on the merits and to deliver the best quality products and services to our economy? Will it be a protection from competition or will it be an exposure to competition with an independent arbiter that looks into the fairness of the game around it?
All right. Maybe we need to shift to antitrust as the core theme of this podcast. And Inge, you oversaw an incredible amount of policy initiatives that are ongoing or that have recently been closed. Just to remind our listeners, we saw the vertical block exemption regulation, the market definition issues, the technology transfer BER. We had the DMA, which was a project of your Director General, of course. Then the reform of Article 22, or not the reform, but the new reading of Article 22 of the merger control regulation, the horizontal guidelines, the horizontal rules, etc., this whole sustainability debate. That's incredible. I wonder how you managed to do all that at the same time. It somehow also reminds me of the, say, 20 years back or so, when we dealt with another large package of reforms, when we introduced Regulation 1 2003 and the Merger Control Regulation. And if we look back to that time, I think we can identify as a certain common theme that it was a time that brought more economics into the application of competition law, that it sort of put more emphasis on what companies are have to do as self-assessment, etc. Can you identify a common theme for the reforms that are now ongoing? Do we look back at this time somehow and say, oh, that was the advent of the more progressive approach or the more interventionist approach or something like that?
I don't know whether there is really a common theme, but I do think that if you are having an important policy instrument in your hand and you are not allowing those policy instruments to evolve and to be also complemented over time, that inevitably the area in which you are active risks becoming less relevant. I think the world around us is changing. Definitely digitalization is a fundamental change in our economy, in our societies. And I think if there is a common theme, digitalization might be one. Well, the Digital Markets Act is a clear example where we saw in 20 years of very active enforcement of our antitrust rules that those antitrust rules also had their limits, in particular to deal in a timely and a resource efficient manner with some of the more structural market failures that we identified. And that was what led us to resort to a different instrument of ex ante regulation to try to in a more structural manner create more room for contestability and fairness in the market. Definitely also a market definition notice, which you refer to. Market definition is more complex in digital times. You have to deal with two-sidedness of markets, and that's not unique to the digital sector, but it's certainly an issue which is very relevant in the digital sector. Also, you can wonder how relevant the SNP test is in zero price products and services. So I think there again, digitalization is having an important influence on that policy initiative. For the horizontal block exemption regulation guidelines that you mentioned, again, information exchange and how we look at that today, also data combination that raises novel issues. And precisely in this context where companies have to self-assess, we want to make sure as well that we give them guidance not only on what is not allowed, because that's what you can read from our prohibition decisions or commitment decisions, but also give some reassuring signals on types of cooperation which are actually seen as pro-competitive. And that's also why we have now again a chapter on sustainability agreements in our horizontal guidelines, to also into this new area where we saw demand for more clarification provide some indications and sticks to help businesses do their self-assessment on what is considered to be anti-competitive and where cooperation can be pro-competitive.
I mean, an area where we haven't seen as much change, maybe at least not in the, let's say, formal legal provisions as in the other areas, is merger control. It's at least my sort of take on it. Some people may argue that Article 22 is a fundamental change or not, but in principle, the merger guidelines have been left untouched more and less. And at the same time, we have a huge discussion in policy circles, but academic circles as well, on how to deal with killer acquisitions. Should we formalize the approach to innovation? We see that in practice, of course, a lot of has changed, how we sort of focus on innovation more than we have, let's say, 20 years ago. But would you expect also a reform of merger control at some point?
Well, I do think that I would tend to agree with the segment that says that there has been quite a bit of evolution in merger control. But I do think that we bring that evolution about through our case handling practices. On substance, we have been looking into complex mergers, because I think that is something to point out, that many of the transactions which are brought to us are complex, not only in terms of the substantive issues that they raise, but also in terms of the sheer volume of files that we are looking at. And I do think that we keep on pushing our analysis, going beyond, for example, traditional horizontal issues, also looking more attentively into non-horizontal conglomerate aspects, pushing for new theories of harms, discussing that extensively also with academia internationally, with fellow agencies around the globe, on how we can there really stay on top of things in how we assess such complex mergers. And we try also to lay down in a transparent manner some of the conclusions that we draw, like we last year published a policy paper on our assessment of digital mergers. Beyond that, you raise an important point with regard to Article 22. We did a detailed assessment of the merger regulation a couple of years ago. We concluded it, I think, in March 2021. And we saw there were two areas where there was room for improvement. One was simplification, in particular for those transactions that do not raise major composition concerns, but which nevertheless set in motion a heavy machinery in terms of notifications and our assessment. And so we're still working on that. We will be finalizing it in the course of this year to bring some simplification into our procedural aspects of merger control by expanding, for example, the categories of simplified mergers. But the second major issue was to point to the fact that we were missing a number of relevant transactions from a competition perspective with our thresholds that remained turnover-based. In particular, in sectors where companies are emerging which do not have a turnover yet, but nevertheless have already a big impact on the competitive parameters in the market. And there were two options. Either we would lower the thresholds in the merger regulation, but then again, we would capture many more transactions that weren't really raising issues. So we decided to reactivate this Article 22 in the merger regulation in order to, in a more targeted manner, take jurisdiction over such transactions. And we took up a first case that was referred to us by a number of member states. It was the Illumina Grail case in biotech and pharma. And that also interpretation has in the meantime been confirmed by the courts. And I would expect also going forward that we would, like, not massively. The idea is not to take on a large number of extra cases, but that we selectively will also be looking into transactions that otherwise would fall below the notification thresholds.
I mean, in the discussions, there are much more drastic proposals. I've just sort of saw the draft report by Professor Repasi in the European Parliament on competition policy, suggesting to actually reverse the burden of proof, for example, for mergers. So I understand that's something that you think we could possibly do without, if I sort of understand you correctly.
Well, the question about the burden of proof and the standard of proof also in mergers is, of course, a very relevant question. It's important also to us. It's the reason why we also appealed the CKA Telecom's judgment of the General Court, and we're now waiting for the Court of Justice to rule on it. Because whether it's mergers or antitrust, the standard of proof, the burden of proof, of course, determines to a large extent how effective we can be as a competition agency, and that's why this is so crucial to us. whether one should take a step further and create presumptions, I think is a debate worth having. What sometimes I thought was a more difficult suggestion, it has, for example, come up when we were negotiating the Digital Markets Act in Council and in Parliament, whether, for example, for digital gatekeepers, one should reimburse the burden of proof and create a presumption that any acquisition made by gatekeepers should be seen a priori as restrictive of competition. I would find that more difficult to justify, you know, why by definition any transaction in that sector, why it would be legitimate to subject it to a different standard. So I think we feel that with the standard that we have, if it is applied in a reasonable manner when it comes to the burden of proof and the standard of proof, is a workable standard. And we haven't seen a need yet to resort to presumptions, in particular in merger control. Of course, some commentators argue when it comes to antitrust that to a certain extent, this is what the Digital Markets Act does, is to create a presumption. I do not fully agree with that because I think that's yet another step further. It's there the legislator who bans outright certain type of behavior because the legislator, for a multitude of reasons, believes it to be harmful behavior. So for me, the DMA does more than creating presumptions in that sense.
So just to close that chapter on merger control, you will not open a formal file on reform of the merger control regulation in 2023.
That's not in the books, but that doesn't mean again that we will not be keeping on evolving and developing our merger control policy. But from what we have seen so far, it's not an opening of the merger regulation which is needed to push and to keep on pushing our policy in this domain.
At least one area a bit untouched in European competition law. Justus mentioned the draft report by René Repasi, and one thing that he suggested for mergers, but I think it's a broader theme, is the Commission should take into account the effects on climate protection, on sustainability, on the rule of law when assessing mergers. And this brings us back to what you said in the beginning, the larger societal impacts of competition policy. Now, do you see that coming? So competition law assessments that really account for competition protection, be it in merger cases or be it in other cases, or is that more like, I don't know, maybe some nice words or something? My question is also based on my sort of perception of the horizontal guidelines on sustainability, where I think that the Commission doesn't go very far in accepting efficiencies that are out of market in particular. So will there be more or is that something that's coming, or how do you assess that?
I think it's important that competition law is not enforced in a vacuum. It's enforced in the reality of an economic context and a societal context. And that's also what the court always reminds us of. Eh? Every case has to be assessed again, of course, on the basis of the law, but also in the concrete context of the case. And that is not only an economic context. But that is something else from starting to integrate different considerations and also policy goals into the assessment. I think the competition rules are drafted such that the focus is on ensuring that the competitive process is protected and that markets and fair competition in markets is not distorted. And that in itself will also...
Oh, Germans love that definition.
They love the definition?
Germans love that definition of the competitive process and everything. You're not mentioning consumer welfare effects here.
No, well, but the consumer welfare, I think that was the point I was going to come to, because I think we have, you know, 70 years almost of competition experience in Germany, even more, where you also see that if you deliver competitive market with that push for innovation, quality and pressure on services, the consumer welfare is the result. And it's, of course, the ultimate finality also in EU law of competition policy. But I think it's a different matter whether because of that wider context, you then start to shift your focus into other issues or start to say, well, we want to promote effective functioning of markets, except when another parameter is coming around the corner. And I think each time we discuss it on the basis of concrete cases, whether it's in merger control or in antitrust, our impression is that we can integrate these other dimensions quite well into the assessment, because whether you look into efficiencies, we look indeed to efficiencies in the relevant markets, but nevertheless, there is a lot of freedom to take those into account. So again, I think it's important that competition law takes into account the context in which it is enforced, but I would also plead for caution not to lose sight of the core objectives and not to create a situation where actually you don't get anything done because you're trying to do too many things at the same time. So it is a healthy framework that the law puts in place for us that we need to focus on the impact on the competitive dynamics and the consequences in terms of consumer welfare, but also in terms of innovation, in terms of dynamic competition that result from it. Will be consequences brought about if we keep on focusing on our core objective, I believe.
I mean, if we assume that, let's say, these dynamic aspects and, let's say, the competitive process are somehow much more difficult to predict in detail, does it mean that the, let's say, more economic approach as we know it has come to an end somehow, or that we have a, let's say, different economic approach because we are not so interested in the, let's say, short-run price effects, which are, well, they are difficult to predict, but they are somehow more easy to predict than the more dynamic aspects of competition, which are inherently more uncertain somehow. So we help ourselves in looking more at structure like we did many, many years ago, let's say. Is that sort of a change of economic approach?
I wouldn't say so. Maybe it's because I'm a lawyer and not an economist, that I would argue that precisely because of the complexity of making these forward-looking assessments, that the economic framework of analysis to develop quite precise theories of harm and to underpin it with the necessary evidence is even more important going forward, and that we need that even more to bring our cases, because the economic analysis, to my mind, really help us, and that's also then what the court expects, to indeed be precise about theories of harm. And what we have seen also in how the law has evolved is that if you have a precise theory of harm, which you underpin with solid evidence, and if you can show that indeed that behavior or that transaction risks to distort competition, that the court is then willing to go along. But you need to have that story which you need to tell in your case and which you need to develop on where the harm is coming from. And there, I think, the pairing of law and economics has been successful in the past decades, and I would think that we push that further. I don't see any reason to reverse on it.
Okay, that will be a great relief to all the economists among our listeners.
But again, that's not to say that one should overdo it, just as I think, again, from an enforcer's perspective, we want to avoid type 1 and type 2 errors. We want to make sure that we have an effective standard to enforce the rules, which must be a meaningful standard. And economics and its introduction in competition policy should not be a reason for lax enforcement. On the contrary, it should help us to find the cases and prohibit cases where appropriate. And sometimes I think that again is a little bit of the reason why I believe we have the Digital Markets Act is the awareness, the realization that to keep on going systematically into all the detail, including the resource and time consuming nature of bringing and showing effects over and over and over again and looking into efficiencies over and over and over again, at some point becomes ineffective from an enforcement perspective. And that's where, for the DMA, the legislator has stepped in and said, okay, this is now enough. For these largest platforms, for that most egregious behavior, we rule by law that this is not legal anymore.
We are not going to ask what's your personal feelings towards the as efficient competitor test at this point. But let me ask a question on the DMA. What's actually going on right now? What are you doing in the commission? How is the prep work going?
It's going very well. I mean, this will, of course, mark 2023. I think for us, the DG Competition, that it's the year that we will start enforcing this new tool. Not only the Digital Markets Act, by the way, also the Foreign Subsidies Regulation is a new instrument that we will start enforcing.
Indeed.
And we are getting ready for it. So we are putting in place an implementing regulation, not least also with the notification form that we want the gatekeepers to use when in summer they will be coming towards us with their notification on meeting the quantitative thresholds. We are putting our case systems in place, and we are meeting with the potential gatekeepers to prepare for those notifications and to have conversations with them. So we are already busy, but the peak load moment for us will be over summer, when we will be assessing the notifications and drafting the designation decisions.
Some people, now that you mentioned the meetings with the gatekeepers, some people warned before that the big GAFA companies are heavy lobbyists in Brussels. Is that something that you feel in your daily work? Is that a problem, lobbyism by different stakeholders and the GAFAs in particular?
Well, I think it's a fact of life, in particular also when new legislation is being developed, that companies and their public affairs firms and representatives express the views of those companies. I would say that once the legislation is in place, it is normal that the gatekeepers build up a relationship with their regulator, because this will be an ongoing relationship, whether they like it or not, for many years to come. And so that's also the spirit that we encounter around the table. An awareness that
it doesn't really sound like a marriage feast or something that you are sort of designing here, a relationship that's going to last for a long time.
But I think, you know, the digital sector is not the first sector that is being regulated. It won't be the last one. I think if you ask the telecoms companies or the energy companies, or banks for that matter, if you live in a sector where there is a regulator, then you need to build up a relationship with that regulator. And I think that requires investing from two sides into where, you know, make each other understand where you're coming from and building the trust. Of course, we'll have to see on how the gatekeepers will continue engaging with us and once they are being designated. But yeah, future will tell. But I don't think the idea is to be festive about it or engage throw a wedding party at it. I think it's just a professional fact of life for us and for them, and we are getting on with it.
I was wondering, we are almost getting to talk about the sort of working at the commission. I thought we also wanted to briefly hear a view of, first of all, what has changed in your view over the last, let's say, decade, the last 10 years working in the commission, maybe particularly in the competition field? And maybe at the end, also tell us a little bit about, Ruprecht and I do have jobs, but there may be other people who are looking. How does the recruitment run and work these days?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I had been out of DG Competition for about 10 years. And when I came back, what struck me is how busy and committed people were. I think that's the first thing, the workload, no doubt, also because in the state aid field, we were very busy with the COVID crisis. Teleworking environment had also hit us, and we have, I think, in an amazing manner, our staff has managed to cope with that and to adjust with it. With this, I think a constant challenge for us is to make most out of this matrix organization that we have, whereby on the one hand, you have the instruments, the merger network, the antitrust network, the state aid networks, where we push the development of the law. But on the other hand, also the sectoral focuses. Because I think we more and more live in times where, as enforcers, we need to be not only effective but also efficient and use the complementarity of our instruments in a very intelligent manner. And to do that, you need to know the sectors very well where you are active. So that is one issue. I think in terms of recruitment, I find that we are doing extremely well. And I find it easier to recruit now than to recruit 10 years ago, for example, because I think youngsters are appealed by the possibility to work for the public sector. They are appealed by the intellectually challenging environment that they find in the Commission and in DG Competition, I would say in particular. And they look for an environment where they can, at the various stages of their lives, combine intellectually challenging work that is worth it with a reasonable work-life balance. And there, I do think that we can compete more effectively on the recruitment market than maybe 10 years ago when salaries were maybe more important to people in selecting their jobs. So from that perspective, it's a great environment. It's a very young environment here in DigiComp. We recruit a lot of people fresh from university. It is a challenge for us to train people on the job. Also, my director tries to play a very constructive role there in giving newcomers the necessary trainings. But of course, most of it you learn on the job.
Well, that sounds almost like as at our university, Ruprecht, doesn't it? So if you like the university, just continue at the European Commission, only with more impact.
With a better salary, better work-life balance and more impact. That's I guess, summarizes it.
And I think if we can also continue to cross-fertilize each other's work, then that makes, I think, both working at university and working at the Commission even more important. I see many of my colleagues also here are either part-time in academia, or we always, I think, try also to be there and try to benefit from the academic debate, definitely, but also here and there try to stimulate it where we can. And I think that's a very fruitful interaction between academia and public enforcers.
If you keep going with these policy initiatives, I think we don't run out of work at universities. That's for sure. I see that. Inge, we are running out of time, and there are about 1,000 projects and ideas and questions that haven't been here now. Maybe just one little last question and a short answer to that. What's your personal number one on the wish list for Regulation 1 2003 successor? For the next regulation that deals with your unit?
Efficient solutions around access to the file, because I think we need to speed up procedures. And I think access to the file, the way it's currently run, is satisfactory to no one.
Excellent. Justus, we can give that as a PhD topic or so for some young researchers, and maybe I guess Inge is speedier than we are with her proposals, but let's see what comes out of that. Inge, it was a treat that you were with us. Thank you so much for this first English edition of Bei Anruf Wettbewerb, which translates into When Competition Calls or something, right? Justus, I think that was what we thought of.
Something like that. I'm not exactly sure what's the translation of the initial movie By Anruf Mord was.
I think that was when Murder Calls or something, but I'm not sure. Okay, yeah.
No, it was Dial M for Murder, so it should be Dial C for Competition. Yeah.
Yeah. And today we dialed Inge Bernards from the DG Competition to get her first-hand answers. Inge, thank you so much. Good luck with all the projects in 2023. We are eagerly awaiting what's coming next from your department, from your directory, and from the Director General in Competition. Anyway, we are following closely what you're doing. And of course, we thank all the listeners, particularly those who have listened in for the first time, since they were for the first time able to understand what Justus and I were saying. Thanks for your interest, and keep listening. Keep subscribing to our show.
Thanks very much, and best of luck and success with all the important work.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.